So Acts chapter 7. Are these things true? The high priest asked. Brothers and fathers, he replied, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham, where he was in Mesopotamia, before he settled in Haran, and said to him, leave your country and relatives and come to the land that I will show you. Then he left the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. From there, after his father died, God had him move to this land in which you are now living. He didn't give him an inheritance in it, not even a foot of ground, but he promised to give it to him as a possession and to his descendants after him, even though he was childless. God spoke in this way. His descendants would be strangers in a foreign country, and they would enslave and oppress them for 400 years. I will judge the nation that they will serve as slaves, God said. After this, they will come out and worship me in this place. And so he gave Abraham the covenant of circumcision. After this, he fathered Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob became the father of the 12 patriarchs. The patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt, but God was with him. Amen.
I don't know if some of you have been enjoying the Winter Olympics, but for me, it's stepping into a world that I know nothing about. It's crazy watching people dressed in tight rubber clothing going 80 miles an hour down an ice track head first in something called skeleton. Or then there's these other events like snow cross, and there's four snowboarders going down at the same time. It just looks like a mayhem. And then they're jumping high in the air and all these sports I don't know about. And every 4 years, the Winter Olympics come out, and I think, I don't know what's going on, but I love it. I get caught up in the ice curling excitement and the hockey and everything you don't normally see. But it's helpful to understand a little bit about the games and what's going on, and so I always appreciate the commentators explaining the rules. And if that's like you when you come to the book of Genesis or to the Bible, I want to encourage you to join me today at 5 o'clock for the extra time. We're going to be looking at how narrative works, how God is speaking truth to us in this form of a story, and just knowing some of the ways in which the story is being told to us and some of the tricks that are going on in the background will really help you feel more comfortable in the narrative. So join me today, 5 o'clock. I look forward to seeing you on Zoom. Again, the information is available online, or contact our administration department for that. I'm very delighted that many of you have joined me in reading the book Providence by John Piper. We've had some good interaction on our WhatsApp group, and so there's still time to join us. You're not left out, but we'd encourage you to look into contemplating what is providence, because it'll help train you to see God's hand, not just in Genesis, it'll help you to see God's hand at work in your own life. So it's really a worthwhile study, and I'm pleased we've been able to do that together. Well, open up your Bible to Genesis 37. I believe it's on page 32 of the Pew Bible. And today we're continuing in a series called Providence. The subtitle is God Meant It for Good. Today we're looking at verses 5 through 11. And this sermon is given the riveting and exciting and dramatic title of Joseph Had a Dream. It just happens to be one of the key points of this text, which is why I chose it as a title. But if that title sounds harmless to you, you are in for a surprise. There is a storm brewing, and this dream is at the center of it. One question we have to ask, and maybe you've wondered yourself, is how do you respond rightly when others treat you wrongly? How can you have the grace to respond with grace when other people treat you without grace at all? It's helpful to consider the story of other people's lives, and Louis Zamperini is a story that is certainly fascinating. So he received international attention when his story was put into a book called Unbroken by Laura Hildenbrand, and then it became a successful film of the same name, Unbroken. And it recounts the harrowing story of an American athlete turned bombardier in World War II. And after he was shot down, he and one other crew member survived 47 days floating in the open sea. They were rescued by Japanese forces and then put into POW camps, where they endured horrific torture from sadistic and cruel soldiers who were overseeing them. Eventually, Zamperini was liberated, and the horrors of war went with him as he left the camp. And he was filled with hate, anxiety, and even anger. When he got back to the United States, he was a hero in the public eye, but inside he was using alcohol to numb his pain, and all the while he was plotting a way to get back to Japan so he could kill and murder those horrible guards who kept him. But God had a different plan. In 1949, Zamperini heard the gospel, and he turned his life over to Christ in repentance and faith. And overnight, God changed this man who was full of fear and hate into a man who was full of peace and courage. He said his nightmares stopped, his fears melted, and his lust for vengeance disappeared. He was overwhelmed by God's forgiveness for his own sins, that he couldn't help but be filled with forgiveness for others. Well, 3 years later, Zamperini returned to Japan. But this time it was to speak about the gospel to the Japanese soldiers. And he went to a prison where there were 850 prisoners. And among those 850, there were many of the former guards who had been cruel to him and other POWs in that camp. He requested to meet with those guards. And as they came forward to meet with him, he recognized them. He recognized and remembered vividly the things that they had done to him and the other soldiers. And here's a question. How would you respond in that moment? These oppressors coming down and you're going to meet with them. What would you do? What would you say? As we look to the text today, it has sibling rivalry. It has hatred. It has jealousy. And if you've experienced any of those things, you know how destructive they can be, whether you've felt them in your own heart or experiencing them from other people. That's why we need to go to Scripture. Ultimately, this will give us the help that we need. And so let's go there together. And though we just read God's Word and stood, I'd invite you again, as we read God's formula, to stand with me as we read Genesis 37, verses 5 through 11. So if you're able, please stand with me. And remember, this is Holy Scripture. Genesis 37, verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. There we were, binding sheaves of grain in the field. Suddenly my sheaf stood up, and yours gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. Are you really going to reign over us?" his brothers asked him. "Are you really going to rule us?" So they hated him even more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream and told it to his brothers. "Look," he said, "I had another dream. And this time the sun, moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." He told his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him. "What kind of a dream is this that you have had?" he said. "Am I and your mother and your brothers really going to come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. The testimony of the Lord is sure. It makes the simple wise. So welcome it today. You may please have a seat. Well, in today's section, there's a big idea. There's a unifying thought. It's this. Genesis 37, 5 through 11 uses two dreams to expose sin so that you will respond rightly to wrong. The first part of this passage is verses 5 through 8. It's summed up with the dream of exaltation at harvest. Then we see the second one in verses 9 through 11, elevation above the heavens. Now, I want you to notice the direct application in this big idea so that you will respond rightly to wrong. This isn't how to control your circumstances or how to manipulate circumstances for your own end. We live in a culture in which we are increasingly led to believe you can change the world. Now, there's some truth to this, but the reality is we have little control over our circumstances or life. If you think you can control the world or change things on a massive scale, you're really being deceived. The fact is, God already has that job under control. He is right now in control of all the circumstances of life. And so life's circumstances under his control, they serve to express his sovereignty through practical living out matters that we call providence. So if you strive to control your circumstances, you'll generally end up weary and frustrated. It just doesn't work. But what God asks of us and what he gives us the grace to do is to respond to our providential circumstances in a manner that pleases him. So imagine the scan comes back and it says cancer. Both godly and wicked will go to the same doctors for the same treatment. The difference is this. In 2 Corinthians 5:9, it says that Christians will make it our aim to please God, regardless of the circumstances. We seek to honor God regardless of whether the treatment is effective or not. That's the fundamental difference. Not that we have different circumstances or that Christians somehow are kept apart from trouble. So as we look at this passage, there are two dreams. They serve multiple purposes in the same time. They're going to expose sin, but they also will show us how to trust God when sin comes against us. They invite us to look for the hand of God, his providence in our own lives. So the first dream, exaltation at harvest, keep an eye out for what God is doing, how he's working to bring about his plans for the good of his people. So let's look back to verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. The most important part of this verse is the response of the brothers. Now, we know that they hate him. We've already seen that in the first 4 verses. So this isn't new information, which should clue us in that this is important information. Repetition is a way to clue you into what the author wants you to notice. But here, it advances a thought of verse 4, but verse 4 had more of a bite. Look back at what it said. It said at the end of verse 4, they hated him and could not bring themselves to speak peaceably to him. Why did they respond in that way? Well, you remember their father had given Joseph a special coat and also loved him above the brothers. They saw favoritism and they did not respond well to it. In fact, they nursed an ugly and deep hatred until it turned into open hostility. And then they hated him even more. Now, in a touch of irony, the name Joseph means to add. And if you read in the Hebrew, it says they Josephed even more hatred. They added to their hatred even more. They're taking Joseph's name and playing with it. He is now the center of this conflict. Now, as you've been noticing the story of Genesis, if you're familiar with it, this might remind you of a story that happens early on in chapter 4. Do you remember those two brothers, Cain and Abel? Back in chapter 4, verse 4, the plot thickens with this thought. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but he did not have regard for Cain and his offering. Those are the circumstances. How did Cain respond? He suspected favoritism. So it says Cain was furious and he looked despondent. So his hatred was so big and so strong inside of him, it came out in his countenance. You could see it on his face. So God mercifully confronts Cain and he warns him and he says this, if you do what's right, won't you be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Well, we all know what happened, don't we? It ruled over him. He met with his brother in the field. He attacked him and he killed him. We're seeing the same story play out here. This is one of the themes throughout Genesis, a sibling rivalry, this conflict that's going on. But it comes because the hatred is taking root. Now we have to consider that no Christian is ever obligated to respond to sin with sin. Because of God's indwelling spirit, we are able to respond rightly to any wrong that will come after us. Now think about this. Even if Jacob had purposefully sought to hurt the other brothers by favoring Joseph, even if he sought to break up the family unity by favoring Joseph, they didn't have to add sin to the sin and make things worse. But things are getting worse, aren't they? Verse 4, they hated Joseph on account of the special coat, but now they hate him even more, and it's because of a dream. It's interesting that we're told about the response before we even get to the dream. So now we turn and look at this dream. Now what's interesting is the dream is straightforward. It's not complicated, it's very simple. He has a dream. But there's a few features in this dream that will be instructive for us. First of all, notice that Joseph initiates the conversation. Now that should catch us off guard because Joseph knows these 11 other brothers hate him. They know that they are very upset with how things are. And so what is he thinking going to these older brothers and initiating this dream? Why pour gasoline on a fire? Was Joseph plucky or was he just being a pest? Well, there are a couple reasons we can dismiss a view that Joseph was being bratty. First of all, this Hebrew word for he told it to them is used when someone is recounting significant information. Information that must be told. It has to be known. And so it reveals that Joseph was compelled to give an account of his dream. An additional reason that we know Joseph was not being bratty was that he tells it to his brothers in a respectful manner. Now, many translations lose a key word in his preamble to the dream. It's this word, please. So a literal translation puts it this way. Please listen to this dream which I had. Joseph is coming with politeness. He's coming with the idea to honor. Now, at this time, dreams were often thought of as a way in which the divine gods or divine beings would communicate to mortals. So dreams were taken seriously. Not every dream, but some dreams had more of a punch to them. And so they would look to interpreters of dreams to tell them what dreams meant. It's common for kings or rulers to have in their cabinet official seers or wise men, they called them, who would interpret their dreams. And so dreams were treated as significant. They were significant, but not irreversible. They weren't set in stone. And so dreams would reveal what the gods might do or what they were planning to do. So it's interesting that while Joseph and his brothers were essentially ranchers and shepherds, the dream is about agriculture. Sheaves of wheat. Now, the family wasn't involved in farming as far as we know, but it was all around them. They would have seen it around them. But what's unusual about the dream and why it caught Joseph's attention primarily was it was unusual circumstances. They were doing something that they don't normally do, which is harvesting wheat. So as Joseph recounts the dream, he gives it in three parts. And it's broken up by a key word, behold, which doesn't often come out in the translation. You might see it with other words, which we'll notice in our translation in CSB. Well, the word behold, or words like it, mean this. Pay attention. Listen up to this. This is what I want you to hear. And so first he says in this dream, there we were, or behold, there we were, binding sheaves of grain in our field. This is a setting. But it struck Joseph as significant. Remember, they're doing something they don't normally do. Well, right after this comes the next, behold. Behold, my sheaves arose and stood upright. This is the inciting action. It's a trigger event of the dream. Now, it's pretty unusual to have sheaves stand up, isn't it? So that's going to catch your attention. Why are they doing this? But notice that Joseph was on the outside watching this happen. He's not involved in the activity. He's just being a witness of what's going on. Which leads to the third part of the dream. Behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bow down to my sheaf. Bowing down means to fall on your face in recognition of another's authority. These sheaves were recognizing Joseph's sheaf's higher ranking. Now again, Joseph wasn't manipulating this. He was simply explaining what had happened. But because of the way it happened, it was significant. And he thought because it involved them, they needed to know about it. Now the meaning is not difficult to understand. The brothers immediately caught on to it. They didn't need an interpreter. But what's in focus here is not so much the dream, but the response to the dream. And this confirms that editorial comment we read in verse 5. And so here comes their hatred. The hatred is like raw sewage spewing out of them. Are you really going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule us? Now, they're emphatic and they're livid. Are you really going to do this? Indeed, you? Is this really going to happen? Are we going to crown you as king? What's the result of this little interaction? Well, things get worse. It says, so they hated him even more because of the dream and what he had said. They already hated him, but now they heap hate upon hate. And it gets repeated in verse 8. And so this verse 5 is keeping us focused on this reality of this hatred going on. It just becomes an envy-producing hatred at the end of verse 11. Now, why do they hate him? There's two reasons. First of all, because he had a dream. They hate him because of the content of the dream, what it represented. And then secondly, they hate him because of what he had said. They hated him just because he told the dream. They had every reason to hate him. They could think of more reasons than that, but that's particularly why they add hate to hate. Now, based upon what we know of Joseph so far, it's unlikely Joseph was being bratty. Now, it's commonly assumed that because he had a favored status, he thought, Dad will protect me. I can just go poke the bear. I can just rile them up and have my fun. But an honest look at this text doesn't allow us to understand Joseph in that way. Joseph was not acting in ungodly pride or foolishness. Now, he certainly knew about their growing hatred of him. In fact, remember he said, please, that expresses a sense of urgency. Please listen. And then that listen also expresses urgency. It was, you've got to listen to this. So it's more likely that Joseph thought God had communicated a message for all of them in this dream. After all, his brothers were in the dream, so they needed to hear it. Well, perhaps Joseph thought that since he was just witnessing the dream, they wouldn't take it out on him. He's just telling them something that he saw. But in reality, they took it exactly the opposite way, that he was lording this over them. Well, think about this. Even if Joseph had bad motives for telling them the dreams, their response was unacceptable. It was wicked. And why would it matter that little brother has a dream? Is that any cause to hate him with such hatred? I mean, think about it. If a child tells of a dream in which he becomes prime minister and all his siblings were his civil or his domestic helpers, is it right to hate a child for a dream like that? Of course not. This is above and beyond what is rational. Now, usually the narrator does not reveal the inner workings of the thoughts and the emotions of the characters. But in this case, we get a lot of attention on the brothers. And it's that same resounding theme. They are full of hatred. And this is designed to contrast Joseph with his brothers. We're not told what's going on with Joseph. And so the brothers give us a mirror, a foil to understand what Joseph is like. We're being told Joseph is the opposite of these brothers. And so we're focusing on them, and that reveals Joseph's character, and find out that it's not pretty what we see. So the response is also pointing out to the greater plot going on of who will be the heir. Joseph has 12 sons. Which of them will the blessing be passed on through? That's the question being asked as we get to this point in the story of Genesis. And so this is a delicate question, it turns out. It's not something you just casually talk about. This is where the plot is progressing, and this is a dangerous question to ask. And by Joseph bringing it up, we understand how dangerous it is to talk about this. Now, one thing we find out is that dreams were common in this book of Genesis. In fact, in dreams like Joseph's, like as I mentioned, they were viewed as messages from God. So when these brothers understood a significant dream and probably understood it as a message from God, when they despised Joseph, what they're actually despising is God. If they're seeing this as God's plan, in despising Joseph's dream, they're despising God's plan. And here's the great irony. Through that plan, God will save their very lives, the lives of these haters. God treats us the same way when we despise his plans for our own lives. So this is just part one, the exaltation at harvest. Then watch what happens with the second dream, the elevation above the heavens. And look at verse 9. Then he had another dream and told it to his brothers. Look, he said, I had another dream. And this time the sun, moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. Now, it starts out like verse 6. And this repetition is telling us to anticipate a similar outcome. Don't expect something different. So it's amazing that Joseph, after that previous experience, goes back and shares with his brothers. I can't imagine walking into that hostile of a situation. But it's doubtful because of that he's going back to rub it in. He has to know enough about his brothers. Two of them had slaughtered an entire village in a revengeful rage. You don't poke these bears of all things. Now, unless Joseph was particularly daft, the ongoing animosity would have stopped him from sharing this if he was trying to lord it over them. What seems most likely is that, again, Joseph believed this was so important, he would risk his life to share it with his brothers. They had to know. So he comes and we sense this urgency, we sense this danger as he approaches his hateful brothers. Now, what's particularly significant here is that this is a second dream. This is a pair of dreams, which this gets played out in this story of Genesis. In chapters 40 and then in chapter 41, we have four more dreams, both come in pairs. What's significant about pairs? If you look over to chapter 41, verse 25, Joseph explains to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed Pharaoh what he is about to do. So when we get to that point in the story, we're meant to think back to this dream and think, aha, that dream, it still has a purpose. It still has a point. It still has a place in the story. We're going to look to what's going on with that dream. We're meant to understand that dreams reveal God's plans. They're guides to his providence. And when there are two brothers or two dreams happening together, we're meant to pay attention to them. Here's a great irony. God is using these double dreams to seemingly antagonize the brothers. God is moving his plans forward through this. Well, here's a second significance about two dreams. If you look at 41, verse 32, Joseph also tells Pharaoh this. The doubling of Pharaoh's dreams means the thing is fixed by God. This was a way of saying that Joseph's dreams, you remember those dreams when you get to 41, think back to these dreams here. These dreams, because there were two of them, they were also fixed by God. So don't lose hope for Joseph when he's in prison. Don't lose hope for God's plan when Joseph is taken out. There's a third significance to the two dreams. And chapter 37 doesn't bring it up, but this comes out later in chapters 41, in particular verses 25, 28, and 32. Joseph there affirms that dreams come from God. Later, we're meant to look back on this and realize this dream was in fact from God. Now, it doesn't mean every dream is meant by God to guide us, but these dreams are from God. We're meant to pay attention to them. Okay, so the second dream in verse 9, it begins with the same idea of the behold happens again. So first he introduces the dream. He says, behold, I have another dream. Or our translation here is CSB, look. Look at this. I had another dream. It's pay attention to this. Then this dream comes after that. So he uses a second behold that sometimes gets lost in the translations because translations will say this sounds redundant to keep using the word behold. We'll take it out. But it's actually helpful to have that repetition. It's meant to get our attention. It's meant to say, don't miss this. So at first there's no response. The brothers don't do anything. But then in verse 10, we see that the father and the brothers are involved, which means there may be a second telling of the dream that Joseph realizes my brothers aren't taking this seriously, so I've got to get dad involved. So he maybe is hoping that dad will tell the brothers, pay attention to this. And why would that be significant that dad would hear about dreams? Because God had done incredible communication, direct revelation to Joseph or to Jacob through dreams. In chapter 28, Jacob has a dream of God blessing him as he had blessed Abraham and Isaac before him. And this was so significant to Jacob that he names the place where that dream happened Bethel, which means the house of God. A second significant dream for Jacob was in chapter 32. There, Jacob is wrestling with the angel of the Lord. He's wrestling until the angel blesses him. And it ends up with the Lord renaming Jacob Israel, a significant moment, and so significant that he renames that place Penuel, which means the face of God. So of all people, Jacob should have had an appreciation for not just one, but two dreams from his son. Jacob should have appreciated it, but he doesn't really express appreciation, does he? In the second dream, as we consider this dream, Joseph is no longer an onlooker, but he's in the center of the dream. But this dream is more vivid because he's in it. Now, he might be thinking that this is a dream that the brothers will want to know about because they receive an honored position. They're presented as stars in the heavens. And then dad and mom are presented as sun and moon. Truly significant positions. So maybe Joseph thought, I'm nothing in the dream. I just happen to be in the middle of it. But you all, you are in positions of honor. This is significant for you. But actually, they don't focus on that at all, do they? They focus on, how dare you, Joseph, think you are better than us. They all notice only that they were bowing down to him. Everybody, Jacob, Reuben, Benjamin, and then the dead mother, Rachel, was also involved in this. So animosity grows. And Jacob, in this passage, is not called Jacob. He's not called Israel. They call him father. He's referred to as father here. Why is that? It's to demonstrate that there's a distance between Joseph and his father. This dream creates a rift between them in a sense. And it comes out with that harsh rebuke. By just calling him father, it's a distant relationship. And also the word father points to Jacob as being the authority figure. And so when Jacob speaks, he's speaking with an authoritative verdict on Joseph. And despite his great love for Joseph, this was even too much for Jacob. And so he corrects Joseph. And correct is probably too mild of a word. He was aggravated, especially by the sun and the moon bowing down. Jacob was not flattered that he was the sun. He was not flattered that Rachel was the moon. He only noticed that they came to bow themselves down to the ground before him. Maybe Jacob was pricked because when he came back from Canaan, he had to bow down 7 times to his brother Esau. And so the thought of bowing down to his son was particularly odious to him. Or maybe it pricked him because he missed dearly his beloved wife, Rachel, who he had buried back in chapter 35. Whatever the reasons that he spoke, he came down hard on Joseph. What's interesting is we're told nothing about Joseph and how this affected him. All we're given is Jacob and his brothers. Now, his brothers had already made their hatred known to him. I can't imagine having 11 people, your brothers, hate you this much. Brothers you have to live with and work with. And so in front of them all, in front of these hating brothers, Jacob rebukes him. He speaks harshly to him in front of everybody. And so verse 11 sums up the response of the brothers. They were jealous of him. Now jealousy is an interesting response at this point. What are they jealous of? Usually you're jealous because somebody has something that you don't. They're more athletic than you. They make more money than you. They drive better cars than you. We're jealous of something they have that we don't. What does Joseph have that they don't have? This jealousy is a hate-fueled jealousy. It's ultimately because they perceive they're at a disadvantage. They perceive God has told Joseph something and it hasn't told them. And what God has told Joseph puts them at a disadvantage. They feel like their honor is being maligned with little honor that they have. And so it indicates that in spite of their hostility, they do understand this as a significant dream. They do take it seriously, but they don't like it. And so when it mentions their jealousy, we're meant to suspect that this hatred is going to build into something. It's going to turn into revenge. And so something horrible is coming. Now there's a bit of vindication here. It doesn't just end poorly. It's the second half of verse 11. But his father kept the matter in mind. He did listen to what Joseph had said. It struck him. And this idea of keeping it in mind means he thought it over. He meditated on it. It's the same idea that after the angel appears to Mary, she contemplates that. But then when all the visitors come and tell her about, as the shepherds come and tell her about the angels in the sky, she contemplates what they said. She meditates on it. In the same way, Jacob is meditating. He's mulling it over. Now, the details are not clear. All that we have is a major plot point. But to keep it in mind means there was serious reflection going on. Jacob was seeking to understand what God was saying through this. And this is a way to point to us that we also should keep this matter in mind. Don't lose track of these dreams, and you won't hear about these dreams for quite a while in the story. And saying to us, they will be important, but not in the way you think they will. Now, what we may not see here is the narrator is purposefully laying out important clues. The narrator, Moses, given the words by God to write this, the narrator is like a masterful detective story author. The clues are discreetly put out there, and they're intended to point to things that we may not realize yet are important until we get further in the story. Then we'll look back and say, aha, there it is. I saw it. I should have seen it. How could I miss that? Of course that was going to happen. It adds up to an amazing ending. And we know this. We've said it before. It comes out so clearly. What it's all pointing to is in chapter 50, verse 20. Joseph says, as for you, you meant it for evil. All these clues, this is what they're for, is that God meant it for good. So here's what's going on now. God is stirring up these brothers so that they will, in fact, send him out of the area. God knows he has to rescue Joseph from these brothers, or they will, in fact, kill him. Now, think about this. If Joseph was not hated by his brothers, they would not have sold him as a slave. If Joseph was not sold as a slave, he would not have ended up in Egypt. If he had not ended up in Egypt, he would not have risen to second in command over the most powerful nation on earth. If he had not risen up to the second highest authority, Egypt, his family would not then have moved to Egypt to be rescued from the famine. If they had not moved to Egypt, their descendants would not have become slaves. If they had not become slaves, God would have lied to Abraham when in Genesis 15, he had said that they would be slaves for 400 years in a foreign land. That's so significant that we heard Stephen record that in Acts 7 today. If they had not become slaves, God would not have brought about judgment on Pharaoh. He would not have made an international name for himself through the plagues and through the Exodus. It all begins here. God is masterfully controlling all these details, including the sin. God is not causing the sin, but he's working it all out. How masterful that is of God. And if he can do that here, he's still doing that in our lives. We could go on and on about all the ways that one thing leads to another, but ultimately it traces the story to our serpent-crushing, punishment-bearing, sin-forgiving Son of God, who became the promised offspring to reconcile sinners to God. Jesus Christ was the one promised to Eve in Genesis chapter 3. So God's providence is very good news. It means that the worst enemy that you may face, God can use them for his good, for your good and his glory. It means that God can bring about incredible purposes. All the events in the cosmos above, on the earth, here, even through viruses like COVID, are designed by God to bring about the precise and exact unfolding of his will at just the right time. God is sovereignly involved in every detail of your life. All things. All things are working together for the good of those who love God. So Christian, there's a reality we have to face up to. There's a promise in the Bible, one that you don't see stitched and embroidered on pillows or on wall hangings. It's in 2 Timothy 2:12. This is a promise. All who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. If you think you can follow Jesus and look respectable to the world, you're mistaken. The times in which we live are hostile. There's opposition here, and it's only going to get worse. Remember what Jesus said? John 15, 18 through 19. It's sobering. Jesus said, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Just as Jacob's special love and choosing of Joseph led to seething hatred and jealousy from his brothers, God's special choosing of us and his love upon us will produce hatred in those outside of his kingdom. Not long after John 15, Jesus said something else. In John 16, verse 33, Jesus told his disciples, and by implication, all those who would follow him after them, "I've said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart. I have overcome the world." Our peace is in Jesus, not in this world. So regardless of how people may respond to you, you are commissioned by the one who has authority over all of heaven and earth to speak the truth in love. Many will hate you for it, even if you're polite, even if you go through all the cultural norms to present the gospel in the nicest possible way, people will still hate you for it. But Jesus promised to always be with you. And we are reminded that you're not responsible for how people respond to God's message. So Christian, don't back down. Remember God's promises. Don't back down out of fear of a negative response to the truth. Make it our aim to please God. Kent Hughes, a pastor and author, wrote this. "We have a God of providence. A God who sustains our souls in all of life, perfectly working good. This is a truth to know now, because life is not going to get easier. In fact, the more you follow God, the more complicated life will become, because your life's course will buck the currents of this world." So Christians, take heart. God is wisely orchestrating every detail. Even the sinful responses against you are meant to bring about your eternal good. Rest in him. Submit to him. Follow him. The true story of Joseph is about the hero, Jesus Christ. He's the hero of your story too. And he'll show himself to be great and mighty, as he did in Zamperini's story. Remember him? The abusers are coming forward. The torturers are coming forward. And as they came forward and Zamperini saw them and remembered what they had done to him, he was overcome with forgiveness for them. And he jumped off the platform and he hugged them. He embraced them. In their shame and in their shock and their confusion, they pulled away from Zamperini. But Zamperini spoke to them about what God had done for them. And one guard asked them, "How can you possibly forgive us after what we did to you?" And he said to this man, Mr. Sasaki, "The greatest story of forgiveness that the world's ever known was at the cross. When Christ was crucified, he said, 'Father, forgive them. They know not what they do.' It is only through the cross that I can come back here and say this to you. I forgive you." All but one guard gave their lives to Christ because of the forgiveness manifested through Zamperini. The worship team is going to come up now and they're going to lead us in a closing song. In the song, it's a prayer. It's asking God's will to be done here on earth. It's asking God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. And sometimes when we ask for that, we're asking God to lead us into dark paths. But we can trust God, our loving shepherd. We're going to ask God that we might have the strength and the courage to speak about the glorious gospel of grace. So let's stand together and give words to our prayers.